I'm Walt Lundgren, Jr. This is the second presentation in a series that I'm calling An Autobiography of Faith. This presentation I'm calling Let There Be Language. It's set out on the board, the word or something like the words, something like that, short, right? So the calligrapher did, and also because we keep thinking about these, I sit in here and listen to Dad talk and I think, okay, I got to change a little bit what I'm going to say, and so I redo the title. And now this is the title, Let There Be Language. I said that this is the second in a series, and some of you may not have been here yesterday. You will not be lost if you were not here yesterday. But I will tell you that what I have decided to do throughout this week is to use myself something as a paradigm for the kinds of experiences that make up faith, perhaps for many people. I don't mean it just to be me. I mean to use my experiences for people generally. It's my hope as we go through these things that you will find yourself remembering. And perhaps in the remembering, you will be naming things that have happened for you, to you, by you in the past, and naming them according to faith words. I'm calling it an autobiography of faith because one of the convictions that I have, which is a premise of this whole series, is that faith is a dramatic thing. It is not a set of proof texts or propositions. It is not restricted to right doctrine. You've heard both Dad and me touch this kind of an issue, and you will hear us touch this issue throughout this week. It is experience. And as experience, it is something that can be, when you look back over your life, it can be kind of traced, even though in the midst of that experience you may not have known what was going on. It becomes dramatic. It is history. It is your history. It is your dance, as it were, with the deity. Two beings in dance together, two beings in relationship, and that's the definition I'm working with when I use the word faith, that it is a relationship with the living God enacted, yea, in this world, in this place, wherever we happen to be, and with all the stuff of this world. When I say relationship, it should be understood that that means that there are two beings or two elements that are committed and active in that relationship. And you are one, that is, we are one, and God is the other one. So it isn't as though one is totally passive and the other is totally active. There is an interaction that goes on between the two of them, and that's what I'm hoping that I can kind of trace and identify five planes or five stages or five passages. I don't know what's the best word to use. Yesterday when we talked about it from the child's point of view, the child not even aware of the fact that the child was aware that there was a deity, a God, even though the child may not have used that word, God. And today I have a double thesis. The one will be simply to say, this is what happens. And the other will be to say, this should happen. They are slightly different. My thesis is that sometime in this process, sometime there needs to occur language. Language needs to come for the child after the experiences that I touched last time, after these non-noetic, non-comprehended experiences with deity. Language finally needs to come, perhaps as a gift of the seas that I have in mind. Language needs to come from the community, that is, from the church. There's two seas. That is, from the caretakers of that child. There's a third sea. The caretakers who may be the parents or the grandparents or teachers or what have you. The church and the community. Language needs to come to the experience of these children or of the child so that it may finally name what the child has not been able to name and explain what the child has not been able to understand and contain, that is, preserve some of these experiences. I will explain this yet as we go on, but this is the first of my two theses, that language is finally necessary and doctrine has its place. And worship has its place, and all the teachings that the church does must be. They must be, and we will say why today. But my second thesis shall be to say, yet when language comes, oh dear seas, caretakers, community, church, be sure that it is loving and be sure that it is realistic. In other words, it can be misused, as was suggested by my dad earlier today. This is not an ending to a story I told you yesterday, but it fits with it. It's a distinct little thing all on its own. And it fits in today. I told you yesterday about the robber that was under my bed. And how I struggled with evil by struggling with that robber. My guess is, my hope is, my dear hope is, that while I was telling you that story, some of you were also remembering the robbers or the ghosts or the bad things that were in your life and all the rules that you had so that you wouldn't get killed or eaten up or hurt or whatever, whatever. Well, I'm going to tell you that language is really two things in this process of faith. That language is the stuff of the experience itself. It is that which is dialogue. It is the talking that goes on between an individual and God or individuals and other individuals. And I'm going to say to you that that language must first be spoken so that a child can understand it. So that the one who's going to come along with the doctrinal language, which names and contains the experience, has earned the right to do so by earning the credibility of the child. Let me underline that a little bit for you. I talk fast because suddenly I remember there's both a tape and there's time. And because the time is running up my back, you can get the tape. Okay. I told you there was a robber in the Bible. My son had something of the very same experience. And my wife is so wise in how she handled it. She used language. It was Matthew. That's our second son. Matthew had grasshoppers. I didn't have a chance to tell him about robbers, okay? So he went to grasshoppers. I think maybe for children there's some kind of a classification of the terrible things that may enter into their lives, and then somewhere they open up a drawer and pull it out, and my kid pulled out grasshoppers. And we didn't fully understand the grasshoppers at first, except that they empowered Matthew to great speeds through the night. Now, if you see Matthew now, he's what, 15 years old, and he's reaching up to my height. At that time, he was only this tall, but I don't think he goes any faster today on the basketball court than Matthew used to go down the hall at night in the darkness from his bed and his bedroom to our bedroom and our bed. Matthew was a shot. And it didn't matter. You know, I mean, nobody at that point knocks on the door and says, "Mom and Dad, is it okay?" He flew into our bedroom. I don't think he touched the floor. He flew with his eyes so wide, and he landed, boom, right between us. Wow, we had to make space for Matthew because of grasshoppers. Grasshoppers lived in Matthew's pillow. That's terrible. Can you imagine that? Except that they weren't just in the pillow itself. The pillow had a hole in it, and it was a deep hole, but the hole had a bottom, and at the bottom of this deep pit, I think maybe Matthew called it Sheol, I don't know. There was grasshoppers, and they were ugly and gnashing, and they wanted to eat him up. When he went to sleep, they weren't there, but while he was sleeping, they came, and they were there. And as soon as he was aware that these clattering, you know what I think of immediately when I hear grasshoppers? I know the kid hadn't read the book of Revelation. When I think of those creatures in the book of Revelation, with hair like women, faces like men, run like horses, made a buzzing, clattering kind of sound with their wings as they flew. Well, grasshoppers that wanted to eat him up. I did one thing about that, and Fan did another thing. I did a foolish, loving, sympathetic, stupid, didn't help one bit kind of thing. I believed him. Well, not waking, okay? I mean, waking, I was a pastor and an adult, but I slept in my dreams. I believed him. I believed my son. I mean, I had seen his terrified eyes. And I know you look at terrified eyes and they're suddenly not there, they're here. And I dreamed that my son and I were walking along, little Matthew, were walking along in a field, and it was a blue sky. It was a clean, good day, and I was full of dread in this dream. But Matthew wasn't. You must know Matthew. At that time, he was mildly hyperactive and jerky and running and all that kind of stuff, and he was just exactly that in my dream. And as we walked along, I wanted so badly to hold my son's hand tight so that he couldn't get away from me. I didn't know what the problem was. It wasn't as though I saw a problem. This is some of the eeriest feeling of dread when the day is sweet. And the day is beautiful and blue and green, and that's what it was, and we were in a field. But my heart hurt, and Matthew was so happy, and I wished that he wouldn't be, but I wished that he would be. Do you understand? Yes. I wanted them to be happy, but I didn't. And you know how kids can, when they're holding hands, they can put their thumb in here and force their hand out of you. They can turn their hand into wax, they can turn it into rubber, and it just slides out of that. In my dream, that's what Matthew did, and he started to run ahead of me. And I said, "Matthew, don't!" Because this was dangerous. Whatever it was dangerous. Matthew ran ahead, and sure enough, There was in this sweet green field a hole. And Matthew ran right for that hole. And Matthew fell into the hole. In my dream, this was a nightmare. And I ran up to the hole as fast as I could possibly go. And my dream is sometimes very, very hard to run. And I got to that hole, and I could see Matthew falling down this hole. I didn't see grasshoppers and so, but he was falling. And this is dangerous. And I promise you, I had two immediate desires in my mind. One was to run back in to get help, and the other one was to jump in after him. And I don't understand that second one. It was, I don't know if I would go faster and catch him. I don't know if I would just suffer what he suffered. I truly don't understand, but this is my dream. And strangely, in my dream, I did both. In the same instant, I jumped in, and I began to run back, and I would wake up. I told Matthew about that dream. Didn't help him a bit. It wasn't language. It wasn't language. And it wasn't language that was leading. All it was a perfect sympathy. I mean, it was a perfect sympathy. I was as much child as Matthew was child. Sympathos. I suffered with the child. That's what sympathy means. Than, however, this is the truth. One night when Matthew had that dream and shot out of his bedroom, flew down the hall, landed between us, no decorum in the child. Didn't matter what we were doing. Than got up with him and went back to his room and talked to him. This is the stuff of experience, but it's the stuff of experience when the caretaker, the see, the church, the community, begins to talk in such a way that it earns the right of listening. Than sat on the side of the bed, and Matthew was in bed himself. Now, I'm saying all this from Than's, I wasn't there, but I think I'm going to be accurate. And let Matthew talk about the dream. Listen while Matthew talked about the dream. The stuff of experience only happens when it's dialogue, when there is talking and listening, not when there is just talking. Listen. And then when Matthew was all done, she said, that's true, something like that. She said, that's true. Yeah, there are grasshoppers. They will eat up children. But they're finicky, she said, something like that. They're finicky grasshoppers, she said. They only live in certain kinds of pillows, she said. And she said, is this the pillow? And Matthew, where's the pillow? Nathan, was that a feather pillow or the other kind? You don't remember? Well, let's say it was a feather pillow. Than took that pillow and literally, before Matthew's eyes, took that pillow away and got a different one, a different kind of pillow, and brought it back. And gave it to me. Took with that pillow whole old grasshoppers and all. He never had that dream again, right? That's language. But that's not this kind of language. It does not contain or name the experience. It is the stuff of the experience itself. It furthers the experience, and gently and quietly it begins to direct the experience. You understand? This is the see, the caretaker, directing the experience. But at the same time, and this is what is so significant, people, it is the caretaker. I would love to say it is the church. It is the church earning the right to talk to the children on this level by first having listened to and talked to the child on this level. It is so necessary. It is necessary that at a certain point, language comes from the community. It can no longer be that language or those explanations, those stories or mythologies which have been made up in the child's mind. It can't be anymore. Now you know, or you ought to know, that children, as they go through this dance with God, they make up all kinds of things. You have all those rules around robbers. You have all the ways you are supposed to walk and the ways you are supposed to act. You have so many beliefs and feelings about the clouds or grasshoppers or the rain or whatever. But the child made all those up. It is a theology. You should understand that. It is a theos logos. It is a theou logos, a word of God or about God. But it isn't a theology which will survive. That's the point. I raise my voice, so that is remembered. It will not survive. The theology which survives must come from God through the community. And finally, it is the community's responsibility to speak that language, that theology, that doctrine to the child in order to name the experiences which that child has been having but has not understood. To name those experiences. I'll define naming in a little while for you. And thereafter to contain or to preserve the experiences so that they may move with this child through adolescence into later life. Because I promise you, if the community does not, three things, make firm, affirm, and confirm what has been happening between the child and God to date. The child will soon doubt them as childish experiences and lose them. I will explain that a little bit. I want to tell you two stories tonight. Both will come from my experience. Both will come about from the same period in my life, both about the age of confirmation, 11, 12, 13 years old. The first story will be silly and stupid and do what you want with it, but it will be sad. The second story will be good and glorious. The first story will be sad because after its experience, nothing ever named it for me, and it stayed silly and stupid. The first story, as I fit with what Dad told you today, the first story will have to do with concepts of and activities of faith. The second with law and gospel. All right? Make yourself comfortable. You don't have to take notes on stories or whatever. My dad's secretary kicked out my tooth. This is the truth. Dad didn't remember this until I reminded him the other day. Oh, Dad was a part of it. We were at Miette Hot Springs in Jasper, Canada, and my father had this habit of throwing people into the air when they were swimming. You know what I'm talking about. We were swimming in the hot springs and the sulfur springs, and you know, it was chipper day and cool and all that kind of stuff. It makes your blood slow, but it makes your heart high. I don't understand the confusion that happens to fathers at times like that. But what he does is he comes up underneath you when you're small enough and you're supposed to stand on his shoulders, and then he rises out of the water and throws you into the air, and then you come down. But he didn't just do that for his children, he did it for his secretary who was alone. You remember that, mother? Well, I was behind that event. I was standing immediately behind it, and she was just standing innocently in the water, the secretary. All of a sudden, the secretary rose out of the water, and her feet flew out behind her like that and caught me right there. And I used to have a double tooth there, one in front and one behind. But her heel, I don't think it damaged her heel one bit. It took my tooth out, boom, just like that. So that there was a big gap. Right now, you'll notice it's gold here. There was a gap behind the front tooth. Well, but I was kind, and we were, I don't know how many miles away from any city with dentists, and besides that, I hated dentists. I had already gone through torment. This is important to the story. I had gone through torment years before when the dentist worked on this dead tooth down here and ripped up the bottom of my mouth like it was some kind of carpeting that he was pulling out of the floor. He cut, ripped it up so that I went home with lacerated jaw, so forth and on, and so that Mom and Dad very kindly, "Are you all right?" And I said, "Yeah." I was fine. Nobody's going to touch my mouth anymore. Because I really had a horror of dentists. And so we were at Miette 2 weeks. And by the end of that, I was beginning to feel a throwing, a pain here. Because what was, well, you can imagine, it was exposed and all, but nobody knew that but me. I didn't even know it because I denied it, except for the pain. And then we drove home, and this pain got worse. And finally, I had to say something. I had to say that I had a pain. And Mom looked in my mouth, and she saw this gaping hole that went up to where behind the tooth. And yeah, it was my dad's secretary. So, because it was so bad, and it was really more than I could stand, it went up into my eye, and the whole thing was beginning to swell. You can imagine, all of you have had such experiences like that. Look at this. See what happens? You start talking about teeth, and people start picking at their teeth. She's got her tongue going up. Either she's remembering, or she's trying to find it. Well, I bet she wasn't the only one. Anyway, because it was so bad, we couldn't wait to get an appointment, and it was late in the season. And so we got, the dentist simply said, "Come after hours," which is like after 6 o'clock. So I walked. I walked from home to where the dentist was, and it was very painful, but I tell you this, all the way that I was walking there, I kept saying, "I will not cry. I'm not going to cry. I don't want to cry. I'm not," and I wasn't crying. All the way there, I wasn't crying. It was getting dark outside. I remember that I walked into the dentist's waiting room. It was went right up to the, you go through a door from the street, and you're in the waiting room, and there was one woman sitting there, all alone, but it must have been 50 coats on the way. I always wonder, when you go to the waiting rooms, and there are 50 courts, what do they do with people? I walked in so carefully. You know how when you carry a bowl of water, you have to walk carefully so that you don't spill it out? I felt that was my soul. And the water in there was tears, but I wasn't going to cry. Don't jostle me, you understand? Because I might cry, but I wasn't going to cry. And this woman she glared at me while I walked in. She had glasses on. And as soon as I came in, she fixed her eyes on me. Like this was terribly important that I walked in. And I took my eyes away because I wasn't going to be jostled. Besides, I was not in no mood to talk to anybody. She said, even before I sat down, she said to me like this. She said, it was almost like an aggressive assault. She said, it always happens. Like that. And I sat down and I looked for a magazine. I didn't know if I should say yes, no, I'm sorry, or thank you. But she kept glaring at me like that, and I tried to look through my magazine, saying, I'm not going to cry. She said, it always happens. Happens every time, she said, staring right at me. And I, you know, I, what, 11 years old, what do you say to that? And I nodded and I smiled. She said, always breaks it off. Always breaks it off, every time. Well, I was beginning to get a picture that I wasn't sure I wanted to see the rest of. She was working her fingers and pulling at her skirt, and she was whittling on her glasses like this, and she said, every time my daughter goes, and tooth pulled, he breaks it off. I did not want this conversation. I was saying to myself, I'm not going to cry. I'm not going to cry. And she kept like a gargoyle, you know, on the side of a cathedral. Learning, you know. He always breaks it off, she said. This is true. And I felt tears closer and closer like this. Now, believe it, people. While we sat there and it was getting dark outside and she was glaring at me, there came from the other side of the clouded window where the room itself was, OR was, a shriek. There came a pure, bloody, honest shriek. Like that. So that the window rattled. And I started swallowing. Like this. And she said, see? Within minutes, the door opened up. You think I'm exaggerating? I don't think I am. Within minutes, the door opened up, and there stood a younger woman. It was her daughter. And her whole face, I remember this. These things are burned in your mind. Her whole face was white with little pink dots all over it. I mean, you know, just because of, I mean, not bloody dots, just pink, because she had lost all of her. And she stood in the doorway like this, and she was swaying. I'm all alone. I'm going to the dentist. And this was his previous patient swaying in the doorway. And the mother leaped up and went to the daughter and put her arms around the daughter. And the daughter said, yep, broke it all. And fainted like potatoes all over her mother, so that they both fell on the floor right at my feet. And her glasses went spinning across the floor like this. I didn't know what to say. I turned pages in my magazine. The old woman, the mother, hollered, Robert! Robert! Like that. And in just a little while, the door opened up to the street, and there stood a man, who I suppose now was the husband and the father and so forth and so on. And he didn't flinch. He didn't, to him this was a natural scene. He walked in and he picked up the daughter who was out, her hair, white, my pants when it went off, and carried it and all like that. And he said, your glasses, and went out. She went over to her glasses like this, picked it up and turned around and glared at me like it was my fault. She said, and went out. I was alone. Me and 50 colts. No dentist yet. You know how bloodless an office is when there's nobody in there but you and yourself? And the dentist opened up the door and he said, it's your turn. And I said, it was not going to cry. And I went in, and I don't know if you know, nowadays they lay you out, right? You can go way back and they give you soft music and pictures to look at. It's like puffing and blowing when you're having a baby. Well, I learned that from Sam. She taught me that. But then they used to sit in chairs that had these little pads, these hard little rubber pads that went to the back of your head and hit right there on those two bumps. And you sat straight up in those chairs like this, and they had plastic handles here. You couldn't put your handle like that, you had to grip those plastic handles. And now they have drills that sweetly wee in your ear. Then they had drills that went and the drills had cords, and you used to stare at those cords thinking, couldn't they go faster? They just vibrated and you could see that guy turn that thing around like that. That's what I sat down in. And I said, I'm not going to cry. And the dentist looked in my mouth like that, looked up underneath it, and he said words I did not understand. Root canal. He said, root canal. But I wasn't going to cry. And then he brought round, just as you can imagine, an enormous needle. And it was my upper, you know, and I began to wish it was my lower, because at least you could put that needle in that soft flesh better than you put it in the hard palate. And he put it in that hard palate. And I felt it go under the hard palate like that, and I cried. One tear. I cried one tear. This is the point of this story. I cried one tear. And I don't know where it came from, but I promise you I did something with that tear. I did. I gave it to Jesus. I said in my heart, with my mouth wide open, there was one tear going down. I could feel that thing go. I said, Jesus, this is yours. I gave it to Jesus. I don't know what that means. I didn't know what that means. Except that the consequence of that is that I had the deepest sense of the presence of God. And I didn't cry anymore. It doesn't mean it didn't hurt anymore, and it doesn't mean I didn't like the hurt anymore. I didn't cry anymore. Because the Jesus to whom I gave that tear was there. That's true. But I thought it was silly. I thought it was silly. I never told my brother. I didn't tell anybody that story. I thought that was childish and foolish, and it was magic, or it was... I thought it was stupid. I didn't tell anybody until just a few years ago, when I started working on a book that called for me to remember these things, and then I called it up and I remembered it. I couldn't tell anybody, because nobody named it for me, what I was doing. Even though I was in confirmation class then, nobody named it. Well, nobody dialogued to find out about it, so I don't blame anybody. I don't blame anybody for not naming it. But I think, you know, this afternoon Dad made the distinction between faith and faith. And he said, we've always been taught that faith is knowledge, you said, assent, and trust. And the implication was, I didn't blame it, but the implication was, it was knowledge of doctrine. The right knowledge of doctrines, of proof texts, of memorizations. And it was assent to this system of theology, in seminaries called systematics. It was agreeing that these things, first you know it, second you agree that it is true, and third, it was trusting those truths somehow, those faceless, mindless, unliving, dead truths to be supportive. And then, as Dad went on to say, he said, no, what faith is knowledge of God. None of these things, knowledge of God. These things may name the knowledge of God, but it is knowledge of the living God. Don't you understand? It's the difference between if Matthew loves, who can I pick on? He used to be, no, I never was, Staubach. Well, it's Michael Jordan. Matthew knows everything about Michael Jordan. Matthew's not here. He knows everything about Michael Jordan. You can ask the stats. He knows everything about. But there's a difference between that kind of a knowledge, that kind of a factual knowledge about Michael Jordan, and should it ever happen that Michael Jordan would come to our house and knock on our door and say, is Matthew here? I want to take them to dinner. Those are two different kinds of knowledge, and faith is the latter knowledge, when it isn't Michael Jordan at all, but the deity who was there in that dentist's office, but nobody named that that was faith. Do you know what I did with that dribbling tear? That was an act of faith. That was an act of faith, and it became trust in the presence of God, that God was present, that Jesus was there. It became that, but because it was never named, I lost it. That's why this is a sad story. I lost the very activity of faith to the words about faith. Do you understand what I'm telling you?
Yes.
I lost the stuff of the experience to the catechetics. Somewhere, the words must come down. They must. Otherwise, children lose these things, and I promise you, children all over the world lose the beginning of the relationship with God, which I also promise you, all children have. I think that's true. All children dance with God. All of them do. I need to read this to you, because otherwise I might mess it up. Be patient with me. It'll ask you to think just a little bit. Oh, no, I don't mean that you're not thinking other times. But I mean, it isn't the same as when I carry you with stories. Listen. First, there is El Shaddai. I told you this yesterday. And relationship, in which the child may have feelings, and often those feelings, as with Orpheus, turn to love. Why? Because the child fears that she might, but she does not die. I told you all that yesterday. And then the child, in various compulsive forms of dialogue with the other, comes to awareness of the relationship and takes up a position within it, which is very close, by the way, to Martin Buber and to Ian Dobbitt. But here, now, the common experiences of children divide. And some continue in faithing, which is what I call this process, and others do not. Listen, please. Unless there is given them a language at the right time, this is kairos, and a means whereby to make experience also intellectual. Unless words, stories, ritual, and doctrine are available to make space in the rational mind for the heart's conviction of God. Unless religion occurs to sustain the personal religious convictions, why, then that conviction is lost with their childhood as the opinions of childhood become more and more suspect to their intelligences. This is just before adolescence, when they have to endure all kinds of scorn from adults. I think that just flips, yeah, it just turns and goes by itself. They endure scorn, and they begin to enter into the adult world, and it really is a chrysalis experience just before adolescence, when you begin to shuck stuff of the childhood, and you hold in contempt things that you were, in order to prove that you belong to the community, to adulthood. Listen. That conviction about God flows into the past. It starves with the host of invisible beings that people childhood, some of them merely imagined, like the robber under the bed. Some of them true, the wickedness of the world, evil itself, the fallen angel being, in fact, the robber under the bed. True indeed, but lost now, for the want of expression and scorned and wasting and dead. Faithing begins by nature in children. The relationship is, first, truly there, but it can, in the vast massacre of neglect, die. Silent parents. Now we talk to the seeds. If you'll switch for a moment, not be the children, but the authority. We talk to the caretakers, to the community, to the church. Silent parents. Parents impoverished of the language of faith. It doesn't matter at this point which religion. It doesn't matter which religion, Christian or other. Parents whose apparatus for explaining experience discounts God as myth, many of those I know. Though their own apparatus in the though their own apparatus, these parents, is only always mythic, however sophisticated, scientific, realistic they may please themselves to think it. Parents who choose to, quote, let my child choose for him herself. These parents are King Herod. And the relationships which their children enjoyed babishly with the deity, these are the innocents of Bethlehem. It is a slaughter unspeakably sad. Without the language to affirm it into and within adulthood, the children cease their nascent believing in God. They step forth into the rational, tactile world, seeking other meanings and purposes, and having none other to believe in, but needing nonetheless to believe, they choose to believe in rationality itself and tactility, in empirical truths. In this, they believe, that they can see a thing and reason from it. No being do they believe in then, but in matter and a method. And purpose devolves to the self-satisfaction of their own beings, their bodies and their minds, and they become the gods whom they obey and propitiate, for there are always gods, whose desires they fulfill. This is the slaughter of the innocents at the strict beginning of the process of salvation, immortally sad. You see why I need to read it, I need to get it right for you. But some of the children do receive a language, some are trained in it by a community who trusts its truth. Some are taught to use it, to fill it up with their precedent and undefined experience. Now that's the important thing. When the language comes, it needs to be so close and realistic to the experience of the children that their experience naturally moves into that language. And when they hear the language, they are not told something totally new, what they're given is words so that they can say, yes, I knew that, but I never knew how to say it before. For them, faithing has been granted continuance. And that, I think, is what our confirmation ought to be. That, I think, is what our Sunday schools ought to be. And what our preaching and our worship and our teaching ought to be. I think it is to name what God has already begun in the people. Even though it is the sacrament of baptism, which is one of the means whereby God begins that, as we talked about it today. Nevertheless, it is God always who is working under some kind of condition with that child, whether it's under the law condition, all people are under the law, or whether it is the love that God is showering on that child, and all people, as you said, are loved by God. These things are true. We become just a little bit arrogant if, when we speak to the people who are emerging into the consciousness of faith, we become a little arrogant if we think that it is up to us to produce that faith in them. I think. Although I know that the Word itself is a means of the Spirit to do that. I know that. But I also think that that Word, as I will give you in my second story, comes in a multiplicity of forms, and that God isn't going to let that child alone without whispering that Word, speaking that Word, crying that Word, weeping that Word. But it is up to us finally then to name that Word as clearly as possible and say, hey kid, why it's Jesus. Or it is the law you've been suffering since you were born. And it is the gospel that sets you free. And I'll show you how in just a minute. But that becomes our job. And don't you understand that the opposite of arrogance is this humbleness, that I would kneel down so that I would be even lower than the child that I'm about to teach. So that first I listen to that child. First I dialogue with that child. The opposite of arrogance is this humility, that I believe that child has something to tell me. No, maybe not to teach me, although sometimes that happens too, but just to tell me so I can see whether it is grasshoppers or a robber, so that I can find out if Max Galetic is punching him in the stomach, so that I can see how this child particularly responds to the sky and the grass and to the experiences around her. That's kind of an important thing, so that when I finally do speak the theology, I'm speaking it to experience, I'm not trying to make it be experience on the child. Does that make sense? Good, good, good. This is the naming. I don't have the time to go through it, except just to touch it for you. I could take a long time to do it. This is what I think happens in the creation story, which you've been hearing something about in the Bible study in the beginning. God creates the world by speaking the world. But that's not the last time that God uses language. God creates the world by speaking the world. You must understand that in the Hebrew mind, when God said, let there be light, it wasn't as though God began some kind of a process that ended up in light. It wasn't the magical word. When God said, let there be light, that word was the light. If you can imagine it, which you can't, it would be as though God opened up the mouth and there was light in the mouth, which filled the world. The word, let there be light, was the light. It was that whenever God said, let there be, the word itself was the creation and was the created thing, which is why John picks up on that later on, you know, and says that the word was God and the word was light and that life was life. All right. Now, but I have to speak. But that's not the only thing God did. God also named the things that God made. Named them. Which was a second sort of a thing and a second use of language. The light God named.
Light.
No. No. What did God name the light?
Day.
Day. Day. That's right.
Did you say day?
Day. No, I didn't. You meant day. And the darkness God named?
Night.
Night. Notice that. And the firmament God named?
Heaven.
The heavens. And the dry land was named? Earth. And so there's a naming process that goes on throughout the whole thing. I just tell you quickly, because I will not have time to undergird it, but you might read Fun Rot. This is where I got this from, on Genesis. When God named things, three things happened. One is that the essence of the thing itself was brought to a level where it may be understood or comprehended. It was brought to a level of consciousness. It was a way in which humanity itself could perceive day and therefore light, and could perceive the sky above and the space between and the earth below. Okay? Number one, its being, its essence, was brought to that level where it could be grasped intellectually. Two, the second thing in the naming was relationships were identified and established. Day and night. Heavens and earth. Ish and good for y'all. Misha. Yeah. So the second thing is, and when I say relationships, that's just a single detail for the whole broadness. Order. Relationships, in perfect relationship with one another, is order. That's what righteousness is, don't you understand? That's what you've been hearing. It's wonderful how our talks all weave together here on a particular week. That's righteousness. So God creates order at the same time. Teaching what right relationships are by the language itself. Oh, I could talk long to show you how language, whenever you talk, you put things in order. You really do. And if you tell the truth, it's a true order. If you lie, it's disorder and destructive. The third thing that God did in the naming of things was to identify purpose. It's sort of like, first it called the being up to a level of understanding. Second of all, linked it with other beings. And third, kicked it in the butt and made it start to go. It said, this is what the name said, why that thing was, why it existed. Be fruitful and multiply. And you see that God did that throughout Scripture thereafter, changing Jacob's name to Israel, and so forth, and so on. Now, but the neat thing is that God said to the man and the woman, you do the same thing. I'll let you do it too. And that's how even Adam participated in creation. They took that ability also for themselves as a gift from God, now let me say it, to name. With the three consequences that I've already identified. That in the naming, the essence otherwise hidden and unconscious may be conscious and rise to understanding. Well, don't you know, there's that beautiful scene. I know there's all kinds of stuff around that scene, but there's some good stuff in it when Eve and Adam come together. Who are the last two that people name? The people. Ish and Isha. It's in joy. That's supposed to be the most joyful scene after all these cows and donkeys and worms and crickets went hopping on by. But God is creating community. When Eve and Adam are put together, that's a gift of God, and it is community. And the beautiful thing is that it's not unconscious community. We don't have to be blind to it. We don't have to be unconscious or numb or stupid about it. But Adam says a pun. Adam says, this is Isha because comes from Ish. And I will go with a pun, not the first and second and all that kind of stuff. You understand what I'm saying? It is self-consciousness. It is that I may name you and you may name me. That's extraordinary. That I may be aware of myself because somebody else named me. Because Than looks at me, I know me, even as I know her. And because I look back at her, I teach her her. I am her mirror. We name one another. But finally, it needs also to be language. I mean, it needs to finally come to a kind of a theology of marriage, or theology of Than Walter, or whatever. We got to talk about it so that we can establish those things. So we have anniversaries, right? And it becomes ritual. And so there are certain truths between us which must be held and believed and entrusted one for another. But we can do that. That's what I mean by naming. That's what I think the seas ought to do. Remember what they stand for. The caretaker, which is parents. I use that term because I want it. I want people to recognize you may be as a sponsor or as a friend, caretaker for some child, whether you're a parent or not. Caretaker, church, community. It is their responsibility. Here is the child. Here is Christ. Now, Christ and the child have been dancing, but the child doesn't know this name, and it doesn't know all the stuff about it. It is the church's responsibility now to name for the child, to bring to consciousness, to identify divine and spiritual relationships, to declare purpose of all these things, to name for the child the deific relationships the child has already been discovering. Otherwise, the child will lose them. And in order to do that, this community must speak, use this language to the child in love and in faithfulness. Love for the child. You must love that child. I say must. I won't even back down on that. If you come unloving to the child will memorize what it is you're telling her, but will not necessarily believe in the buts what you're telling her. The love must be there so that if you're going to talk about relationship, dear people, you must be willing also to live it. And whenever you talk religion or theology to people, you are talking relationship. And it isn't just between one and God. It is between one God and me, because I am the proclaimer. You are the proclaimer when you do the talking. You are the evangelist. You cannot speak relationship without being willing to risk it So you do it in love. And when I say faithfulness, all this is very careful, outline in my head. When I say faithfulness, what I mean is, like Than talking to Matthew, it is being faithful to the experiences which the child has already had. Who takes the time to that? You should. This is the beauty of churches. Churches should have that opportunity to ask. But as you speak, since you are this kind of an intermediary as a teacher or a theologian, you must also then speak in love to the child, but I mean in speak to the child with faithfulness to the Christ, the God, and what God has already declared in Scripture to be the language which identifies this relationship. Faithfulness to it. Let me see what happens. You take the specific, unique details of this child's life, and you fix it in the universal declarations of God. If you are faithful both to the child's experience and to what God has declared in the Scriptures, God speaks and does for all people. Are you with me? I hope so. Well, get the tape.
Faithlessness.
Oh, did I say faithlessness?
No, you said faithfulness.
Oh, but I wrote faithlessness. And it doesn't have two L's. I know that. And the second is trust. As you speak to the child, you speak with love for the child, with faithfulness for the child, with faithfulness for God, and with trust in God. Trust that God is acting, not only by your words, certainly by your words, but otherwise in that child's life. And then, in fact, what you're doing is naming things that may be invisible to your eye when you speak to the child. What a wonderful thing you can do. Name what is invisible. Let me tell you my second story. This is a good story. Because what happened to me was made, and it was preserved, and it became real. And part of the naming happened in confirmation, and part of it happened afterward. Well, here's where part of the naming came. I didn't come with a whole lot of love at this particular point. Not a bad pastor. Not a bad pastor at all. Just a harassed pastor, perhaps. What is the law? The law is God's command that we be holy in heart and life. You shall be holy, for I, the Lord your God, am holy. That's what we were talking about today. Little proof text just added on. It's sort of as though one is the bullet and the other is the wad behind the bullet. What is the gospel? The gospel is the glad tidings that God, in his great love, sent his son, I'm reading out of the catechism, sent his son, Jesus Christ, into the world to save sinners. That's the gospel. God didn't take me off my feet, hearing it like that. But nevertheless, I got the words, law and gospel. I got them, and I began to understand intellectually what they were. They did not relate to my life yet. The words were coming. The words were coming. I'll tell you the story. This is, again, Canada. We were living in Edmonton at the time. Dad was the president of Concordia College, okay? That's big stuff. I mean, I knew it was big stuff because the students, they gave me the stuff I couldn't give Dad. Now, some of them, I mean, Walter McDonald, remember him?
Yes.
He was all right. But there are others that I just had to walk onto the basketball court, and some guy would holler out and say, "Who do you think you are?" Because I was the son of the president. I mean, it was big stuff, president. Again, I was about 11, 12 when this happened. We used to, in the summer, we used to play in the hockey rink. In Canada, you know, all colleges have hockey rinks outdoors. And when I came back down to the States, I thought something was missing on every campus. And in every city in Evansville, ice. I miss ice in Evansville. But we could play in the hockey rink in the summer, not in the winter. You know, they were very careful about the smoothness of that. But in the summer we did. And we played football because it was perfect. Because, you know, it made a perfect field for us, and it had the lines, the red lines and the blue lines, on the wall, so that we knew how far we could run, so forth and so on. We only had one problem in the beginning of the season, is that always there were stones in the field left over. Only God knew how the stones get to the ground in Wisconsin and to hockey fields in Canada. Well, see, because we played with our socks. We always played in our socks. Sorry, Mom. No shoes, no bare feet, socks. I don't know why that was the way to play, but that was the way to play. And if there were stones on the field, you could ruin your foot, you know, if you hit it. So for the first week or two of playing football in the hockey rink, what we would do is simply pick up stones and throw them out until finally it was all smooth and we could play our football within that rink. This was our game. This is Feller, Harold Woody, my brother Paul, Richard Reap, Larry, others, Jimmy Demas. It was good. It was very good. But I wasn't a sports person. I really wasn't. They allowed me to play. When I used to pick up the stones, I would wing them at the lights. Because I always missed. Always. I couldn't even get those stones up there. 6,000 watt bulbs that shined down in those days on the rink. Now, one time when my dad was walking by the rink, and you must remember that dad was the president of the college, dad saw me wing such a stone. And he said, don't. He said, don't throw stones like that. I said, it's okay, I never hit them. He said, that's a 6,000 watt bulb up there. I remember that, it's precise. I don't know if they have those lights there, but if you go back, he said, 6,000 watt bulb up there. Don't you throw stones. I said, I never hit them. So I kept doing what I did. Dad didn't know how poor my arm was. How foolish fathers. Well, there came a day when I picked up a stone off the ground, which must have been magic. And I threw that stone up. I didn't even look long. I glanced at a light and I threw that stone up, but I knew the instant that stone left my finger, it was perfect. And I honestly, again, I was split between feelings. I watched that stone slow motion sail up to that light and slow down as it got to the light itself. I marveled at the thing that I had done, and I began to be afraid. I saw that stone go right up and just touch. 6,000 watt bulb, just tink, like that, that's all. And down came the stone and all the shards of glass, sparkling in the sunlight, spreading out over the field. 6,000 watts. That's a very big number. And my dad had said, Don't you do that. And I said, I never hit it. There began for me at that point a secret, sad war. I began to suffer. And I have to make it short for you. I could tell you lengthy time what I went through. I couldn't look dad in the eyes. I knew he didn't know. The issue was not his knowing or not, although that was part of it. I didn't want him to find out. But I had done what he said don't do. And I suffered my inability to look him in the eyes. And do you know what? Maybe you will understand this. If he would do a simple thing like touch me on the shoulder, it burned me. It burned me for him to touch. I didn't want him to touch. And I didn't want him to love. And I didn't understand all this stuff, just like I didn't understand my tear. I did not understand that I was unworthy of any kind of love at that point. And I couldn't talk to. I kept my eyes down all the time. I went elsewhere. I was uncomfortable to eat meals. And I tried all kinds of things. I tried self-pity, and it didn't work. You know how good self-pity is when you get a good cry, and it's not your fault, and somebody's hurt you, and you cry until your throat hurts? And it just feels so good to get out because everyone's so bad and you're so good. I couldn't do that, because I was bad. I had done it. This thing stuck in me for several days. And all I can tell you is that it began to get worse. I couldn't read my books from the library. I used to soak in the bathroom on Saturday afternoons after going to the bookmobile and just enjoy those books. I wasn't worthy of reading books. Do you understand what I'm saying? It's sort of like you have to be worthy of rest and relaxation. You have to be worthy of a warm tub. You have to be worthy of love. And I was worthy of none of those things. They didn't work. I hated myself. Well, so I don't remember making this decision, but it was as though there was no choice. I was going to go to Dad and tell him. And he was in his study over at the great big college. He was the president. I'm sure I'm going to describe this study differently from the way it really is. But I'll tell you what, on the way over to that study, my rear end started talking to me. there were times when I got spankings, and your butt remembers that almost as well as everything else. Do you know that this child goes and thinks there's a spanking, and several things happen? First of all those muscles tighten up and clench shut. But they tingle. My butt tingled. I could feel it just tingling as I was going. It was like I had a whole shooting star. I had all kinds of wonderful colors coming behind me. I went into where the office was, and the office was closed. It looked to me like a big oaken door. It looked dark in that hall. It looked German. It looked Teutonic. I walked to the door, and it was like, because I knew what was going to happen. I had done what Dad said, don't do, and okay. So, I was experiencing all kinds. knock on the door like this, tippy, 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 tippy. Maybe, you know, you can say, maybe he won't hear me, but on the other hand, you know you're going to have to knock harder if he doesn't knock, knock. And so I went in, and Dad was sitting behind the desk. Yeah. Didn't have white hair in those days, but he was the president. And this was an enormous office. I'm sure it was an oaken desk. And very, if you listen, you could hear in that desk growling. It's all the oaks growling. But I stood there shrinking in front of the desk, and I said, Dad, do you know that light bulb? I had a time. And yes, he said, and I said, I told him. And he looked at me long. Now, you check out those eyebrows. They go up. Like that. He used to sit there and wiggle. Like that. I'm trying to do this myself now, because it gives a kind of a devilish look. He looked at those glasses. He was wearing glasses, horn-rimmed, and looked at me like that. And I knew it was coming. My butt just cried out all kinds of choruses that it was coming for it. He said, you know you're going to have to pay for it. I remember that. And I said, yes. And I don't know, maybe you remember what you saw on my face or whatever, but he got up and he walked around the desk and he came to me and he killed me with a hug. The hug killed me. It killed me. I didn't expect that. I couldn't stand hugs. I could not stand that hug. I was unworthy of that hug. And I wouldn't have cried if he'd spanked me, but I cried with a hug. I cried with a hug. Now, I tell you this quickly. It was things like law, gospel, that began to speak to that kind of an experience. Not directly, I have to promise you, not directly and not well, but began to speak to it. Because what I'm telling you, you must see in the story I told you, was the gospel. It was the law that I suffered. It was hell that I suffered. It was hell. That is not a metaphor. I suffered hell. And it was something else I discovered from the outside, from a human being that came. But do you know what became my catechism to teach me what these things mean? Do you know when the big C started talking to me, caretaker, church and community? This is the Brothers Karamazov by Fyodor Dostoevsky, which I read in high school. I read it after Crime and Punishment in my junior year. I was very lonely. That's the next day, okay? But I tell you real fast, I'll tell you fast, that in this book is in experience, law and gospel. In Crime and Punishment, you see a person suffering that law. You see a person suffering. Father Zosima says in this book, but I can't read it to you because this is an abridged version, and it's the only one in your library. Father Zosima says, what is hell? He says, hell is finally knowing what love is and not being loved. He says, what is hell? He says, hell is finally knowing what love is and being unable to love. That's what hell is, he says. And I read that and I understood it because that spoke to my experience. That was C and C and C talking to me. That was Dostoevsky of the community. And yet in this second book, The Brothers Karamazov, there comes an extraordinary moment of confession, which I would love to tell you when Dmitri makes a confession, but can't because I'm running out of time. But it was the reading of that confession when Dmitri stripped down bare naked in front of all the people who were dressed, and the only thing that Dmitri hated was that his toenail could be seen, and it was in the shape of a slug. I understood that because it spoke to how I felt in front of the desk when I was about to speak the terrible bare naked truth of who I was. But after Dmitri has made that confession, oh, the most sweetest thing happens. He falls asleep and he wakes up. He thinks he's trash. He thinks he's nothing after that. He would accept anything they did to him. When he wakes up after his sleep, someone has put a pillow under his head. And he weeps. He says, who would do this for me? Who would put a pillow under my head? I don't deserve a pillow. It's the minorest, measliest little piece of kindness that has been done to him. But for him, it is glory. Because in the confession, he had become nothing. From that point on, any gift is a gift as fulsome as heaven itself. And I understood that. I understood how love can kill. Because it did. But it took somebody with those kinds of words. Somewhere I say, here in conclusion, somewhere at some point then, C must speak. And it must speak the theologic truth. But it must, and in order to contain these experiences, but it must speak it to the child, not at the child.